Hello, and thank you for listening to the podcast of the Vineyard Church Maryville here in Maryville, Tennessee. If you haven't already, you can visit our website to find out more information about our church or to find our full audio archive with all of our messages. So you can find all of that at www.vineyardchurch.us, or you can also subscribe on Apple and Google Podcasts. Now, let's hear this week's message.
Good morning, folks. Good to be with you. We are in the book of Habakkuk, and we're going to dive right in. We got started last week, and we're going to jump right in. Week 2, chapter 2. Last week, we covered chapter 1, where if you missed it, you probably want to grab the podcast, but we'll give you a little bit of a recap. In chapter 1, Habakkuk looks around. He sees the evil and the ickiness and the weirdness and the awfulness of his society, and he gets really frustrated because God's not doing anything about it, and he goes to God looking for answers, and he goes, God, are you going to do anything about this or not? You're just going to sit and watch. And God replies, essentially saying, man, you think you're frustrated? You should be as holy as I am and see how frustrated you are by people's sin. Don't worry, Habakkuk. I have a plan. I am going to address the sins of Israel. And we read you verse 5. He said this, look around at the nations, look and be amazed. For I'm doing something in your own day, something you wouldn't believe even if someone told you about it. This verse cracks me up every single time I read it because I have seen over the years so many Christians yank this verse out of context and, you know, sort of really uber positive, triumphalistic Christian types, and they put it on coffee mugs and they put it on bookmarks and they say, God is going to do something amazing in our day. You wouldn't believe it even if you saw it. Even if I told you, you wouldn't believe God's going to do something amazing. But the problem is if you keep reading, you realize that what God was planning to do that was so amazing was that he was raising up the Babylonians to pillage and plunder and torture as instruments of wrath. Something amazing. God's going to do something amazing. Like, guys, please, I know I've said it a million times. Let's make it a million and one. Please read, understand, and quote the Bible in context. In context. Anyway, so that happens, and then Habakkuk's really flustered because he got what he was asking for. He just got a lot more than what he was expecting. Has that ever happened to you? You get what you're asking for? It's a lot more than what you were expecting. A few years ago, I was playing a game of memory with my daughter, Brianna. She was about 8 at the time. And she kept beating me, and no, I wasn't letting her. She's just really good at that game. And I said, look, if you win this time, you can hit me as hard as you want, okay? As hard as you want. And I was determined to win, and I lost, and it wasn't close. And she didn't, afterwards, I was like, all right, let's go. Let daddy have it. Come on, hit me as hard as you want. And she was like, I don't want, because she's a decent person. She didn't want to just punch me for no reason. She felt good about winning. Why did she want to do that? But I was kind of curious how hard, like, how strong is my 8-year-old daughter these days? Let's go. And it's like, it's okay. It's okay, baby. Daddy is very big and very strong. You can't hurt him. You know how you lie to your kids? That's what I did. I lied to my kids. You can't hurt me. She punched me so hard. And then when I finally, like, got myself back together and could breathe again, I said, see, you didn't hurt daddy. Just like I said, I just lied to her again. And then I walked out and Sharon was like, what happened to you? And I said, something amazing. Something amazing. Sometimes you get more than what you're looking for. So that's what happened to him. He's real frustrated about that. And he argues with the Lord about that. And then in chapter 2, he waits for his response from the Lord about that. So let's read some of that. We'll start in verse 1. I will climb up to my watchtower and stand at my guard post. There I will wait to see what the Lord says and how he will answer my complaint. What he does, this is a great move by Habakkuk. He goes, look, I'm trying to hear from the Lord. I'm really confused. I'm kind of flustered right now. Here's what I'm going to do. It's act of wisdom. I'm going to find a place. I'm going to get alone. And I'm going to wait to hear from the Lord. And maybe I'll wait 2 minutes or maybe I'll wait 2 months. But I'm going to wait to hear from the Lord. I just wonder how often we actually completely miss out on God's message because we're unwilling to do this. Just get alone. Be still. Okay. This in case you're picturing it, no phones are involved in this. You're not scrolling social media when this happens. Get alone, be still, and wait. It's an interesting detail that he goes up to the watchtower to do this. There's a couple things going on with that. The watchtower is where you would go to stand guard if you were expecting an outside attack. So there's a part of Babylon of Habakkuk here where I think he is acknowledging the truth of the Lord's word, which is that the Babylonians are coming. They're coming. God said it's going to happen. It's going to happen. I'm just as well, if I'm going to wrestle with the Lord, I'm just as well to do it from the watchtower. Also, the watchtower was a high point from which you could see lots and lots, ideally as far as possible in every direction. So he could see his people, he could see the world around him. Again, we talk about getting alone and waiting. Get alone, get perspective, see a bigger picture. We have a hard time seeing past our own noses sometimes. Get alone to a high place, doesn't have to be literally high, but a place where you can take in a larger perspective and allow God to speak to you from there. All right, verse 2. Then the Lord said to me, write my answer plainly on tablets so that a runner can carry the correct message to others. This vision is for a future time. It describes the end, and it will be fulfilled. If it seems slow in coming, wait patiently, for it will surely take place. It will not be delayed. So this is great. Habakkuk's off to a great start. He gets alone, waits to hear from God. He hears from God. God says, I'm going to answer you. It's going to be right. It's going to be good. Take notes. And he begins, verse 4, essentially with his thesis statement, kind of the overarching idea for chapter 4. Really, actually, for the whole book. Verse 4, look at the proud. They trust in themselves, and their lives are crooked. But the righteous will live by their faithfulness to God. Remember that one, church kids? The righteous live by faith. Verse 4 is the central verse of this book. If you wanted, you might could actually make an argument that this is one of the central verses of the whole Bible. Here's what he says. Big picture here, guys. There are two types of people in this world. Two types. There are the unrighteous who are proud and they trust in themselves. And there are the righteous who trust in God and live by faith. Two types. The ones who look around, take things in, and they figure, yeah, I know best. And then they say the three dumbest words ever to be spoken in succession. I got this. And then there are the other people. The people who look around and they see their own frailty, they see their own weakness, their own vulnerability, and they bow their knee and they submit to God and say, you got this. Whatever you say goes. Whatever you say. So we need to stick with me for this part. I'd like for you to pay attention for all of it, but lean in right now in general, especially because I'm going to summarize basically the whole book. Very quickly, and you got to hear it or it's not going to make sense, okay? Some of this will be a recap. Number one, Habakkuk explains the sin of his people. He asks God to do something about it. Number two, God says he's sending the Babylonians to take the Israelites off into exile. Number three, Habakkuk says, no, that's way too much, and it's unjust because the Babylonians are even more wicked than we are. They can't win. And number four, and this is today, number four, God takes, is very interesting, he takes the same complaints that Habakkuk has listed about his people, the Israelites, and then shows him that the Babylonians do all the same stuff, just worse. The Israelites, he points out, are on the same path as the Babylonians. They just haven't gone quite as far. It's too late for the Babylonians. It's not too late for them. And God is kind enough to do whatever it takes to knock them off their path before it's too late. And then, number five, and this is chapter 3. We'll look at this moving in the next couple of weeks. We see Habakkuk's response, and Habakkuk's response is pure worship to God. Now, why? Why would that be? God says, you're on the same path as you are, and so I'm going to knock you down a few pegs before it's too late. And his response to that is worship. Why? Why would that be worship? And here's, because Habakkuk is finally starting to get it. He's starting to see a bigger picture. Let's imagine this. Let's imagine that I just come out of nowhere. You're standing there minding your own business, and I come at you in a full sprint, just barreling full speed ahead. And let's pretend that I'm going really fast. Let's pretend that I am as big and strong as I tell my children I am. And I'm charging full speed ahead, and I tackle you. And I just crush. You didn't see it coming, all right? And I nail, and it's big, like probably some broken ribs. You hit the pavement pretty hard. You're probably concussed. I nailed you. Here's the thing. After that, you and I, we're probably not good, you know? Like, I'm betting you leave the church. You might be like, I like the sermons, but I can't get past that one time. You know, that would be a problem. Unless, of course, you get up, dazed and confused, and you realize that I tackled you to keep you from being hit by an oncoming train or a speeding bullet or an out-of-control bus or something like that, in which case our relationship is not worse. It's quite a lot better. I went from being a goat to the goat in your mind just like that. Now I'm a hero, all right? And let's think about that for a minute. I'm a hero. Okay, moving on. This is what Habakkuk's finally getting. He's realizing this is very hard. This is a step of maturity to begin to embrace this. He goes, discipline is love. It's mercy to get busted. It's kindness to be taken down. It's a gift to get tackled. That's what he's seeing. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to quickly highlight three of the bigger themes in the rest of this chapter as God shows the extreme nature of the Babylonian sin. They've gone so far down the road. And he highlights the Israelites. They've come, not quite so far, but they've come down the road. And they're headed down the same path. And then we are going to ask ourselves, how far, if we have, maybe, have we gone down those same paths? And here's the thing, like the Babylonians way down the road, the Israelites not so far, and us, maybe we're miles and miles down that road. Maybe it's only a step or two. Maybe we're just looking longingly down that road. But either way, we got to see it. Either way, we're going to look, we're going to be honest, I hope, that's the idea, and we got to see it. And then bow our knees and submit to our King before it ruins it. If we need it, we are going to get tackled. That's what we're doing. Welcome to the Vineyard. I'm so glad that you're here. And let me just say this as well before I jump in. We got an uphill battle from here, because if there is something in your life that we highlight today that you need to get tackled for out of love, if that's the case, you're not going to want to see it. It's just human nature. Our own biases are really, really strong. We don't want to see what we don't want to see. And so we choose most often to just not see them. You know, I think of the Pharisees who Jesus confronted again and again. He was like, hey, you got this, you got this, you got this. And never once did they go, you know what? Here's the thing. I mean, he's raising people from the dead and everybody's getting healed and everything he says is true and we can't try to trick him up. We keep trying to trip him up about stuff and then he smashes us. We can't even hang with him. And he says he's the Son of God. Maybe we should listen to what he's saying? Like, that apparently never happens. Instead, they just got more angry and more angry and eventually we need to kill him. And it led to his crucifixion because people who did not want to see what they did not want to see refused to see it. So I'm not calling you Pharisees. I'm just saying that's what's up. We're up against. That's the hill we've got to climb here. So we're going to look at three warnings. I'm gonna kind of punch hard and fast, just like the scripture does. So buckle up. All right, number one. The first that we see here is the love of money at the expense of people. Love of money, and specifically at the expense of people. Now remember, we're looking at the Babylonians who have gone way down this road. We're trying to honestly evaluate if we have headed down this path ourselves, even if just a little bit, okay? So verses 9 to 13, let's read these quickly. What sorrow awaits you, this is the Lord speaking, what sorrow awaits you who build big houses with money gained dishonestly. You believe your wealth will buy security, putting your family's nest beyond the reach of danger. You better believe we're coming back to that sentence. Verse 10, but by the murders you committed, you have shamed your name and forfeited your lives. The very stones in the walls cry out against you, and the beams in the ceilings echo the complaint. What sorrow awaits you who build cities with money gained through murder and corruption? Has not the Lord of Heaven's armies promised that the wealth of nations will turn to ashes? They work so hard, but all in vain. All right, now this is, referring to the Babylonians, this is the extreme end of the reckless pursuit of money. The Babylonians came and they conquered the weak and they took everything for themselves. Now, I'm betting at least most of us have never done that, all right? I'm betting few, if any of us, have ever pillaged and plundered. If so, no judgment. I want to hear that story so bad. Come tell me that story. But notice, that's not where he begins. He begins with a warning about building houses with money that's gained dishonestly. And so here's where we stop. We hit pause. We ask a question. Might be a hard one. Might be an easy one. Might be really tough. Think about how you make your money. Does your business take advantage of the weak? Does it fearmonger? Does it pursue the vulnerable? Is there gain through manipulation? Are there unjust working conditions or discriminatory hiring practices? On and on we could go. We could just say it this way. Would Jesus work where you work? Would Jesus work there? Or we can shift and look at it a bit more personally. So what about you? Have you, you know, on the dealings along the way, have you maybe fudged the reports a little bit here and there or skewed the numbers here and there? Or in your own household, maybe cheated on your taxes, fudged this way and that? Here's the question, the overarching question. It's not fun. We don't want to see it if it's there, but if so, we got to see it. Does the way you make money, the way you move forward financially, does it harm other people in any way? Is it dishonest in any way? If so, you don't want to see it. So you're going to have to try to squint and strain if it's there because you need to see it. Listen to me. If your work cannot be worship, something is terribly wrong. If it can't be worship, it's wrong. Something's wrong. All right. Now, again, from verse 9, I'll reread to you a portion of this. Look out, Americans. Here we go. You believe your wealth will buy security, putting your family's nest beyond the reach of danger. Say just a second here while we're all having fun together and talk about the idol, the myth, guys, the myth of financial security. And it's one of the most insidious and devastating of them all, and it might be the one that plagues our nation, even Christians in our nation, the most. The idol, the myth, financial security. I'll tell you something. Over the years, my wife, because she's a good and godly woman, she would, while we were talking or praying or whatever, she would say, hey, let's talk about this. I want us to make sure that we're not just chasing the American dream. Like, I don't want to be those people that in the end what's really driving them is they just want to keep up with the Joneses and get the American dream. And for years she would say this to me, and honestly, I agree, that's true. I would just be like, kind of like you. I'd be like, hey man, okay, and then we would keep going. Because I'm just kidding, I was mean. It's not in my heart, I love you. But it just didn't land with me, because here's what I thought. I was like, I don't give one rip about the American dream, and I never have. So yes, shouldn't be concerned with the American dream. I don't care, though, but we can pray about it. Like, you know, maybe it's your weakness. So this would happen over the years, and it just, okay, and I would pray about it, and it would land, but not really, and it just, you know, because I didn't care. Here, I just had this simple arrangement. God, here's the deal. I'll do whatever God says, and he'll take care of all that stuff. I'll just be obedient, and he's got it. Deal. Never cared about the American dream until I got it, and suddenly I was afraid to lose it. It happened all at once. We bought this beautiful house,
And the house is a gift from the Lord. I could tell you so many like miraculous stories about how it's the favor of the Lord that we got in this beautiful house. But it's a beautiful place, and it's not ridiculous or anything. But I wake up every morning, and I'm like, I can't believe I live here. This is a gorgeous home, and we live in this house. And that was one thing. And then not long after that, we met with a financial advisor, and she was very sharp. And she said, you know what? If you can stay on the same track you're on now, you should be able to retire on time. I thought, okay, I don't care, but great, wonderful. But then those two things together, something in my mind that I didn't even realize it caught and go, ooh, you got the American dream. I don't know why those were the metrics for me. I had never thought about it. I didn't decide, but those became the things. And I was like, now we're on track. Now I got it. And now I'm afraid to lose it. And I started worrying about things I'd never worried about before. Thinking and caring about things I'd never given two thoughts to before. And I woke up one morning, it was a Sunday morning. I woke up on Sunday morning, and as I woke up, the Lord just showed it to me, clear as a bell, and I just felt convicted. And it was like, we had this arrangement, right? Like, you were going to obey me, and then I'll take care of that stuff, and you don't worry about it. But along the way, I thought, I'm not going to do it, but you'll need my help a little bit by me worrying about it. That will help you, God, with what you're doing. I'll just worry a little, and that'll help. And the Lord was like, hey, that's so dumb. And I felt so convicted. And it was a rough morning. I kind of come dragging into church. And as I walk in, Natasha's standing there. Wait, it's Natasha. Of course it's Natasha. And Natasha pulls me aside. She's like, hey, I was praying for you this morning. I was like, of course you were. I was praying for you this morning. And the Lord spoke to me. And he said that you were concerned about things that weren't yours to carry. And he wanted you to trust him with that completely. And she said, could that be from the Lord? And I was like, no, go away. That's not happened. I was like, dang it, yes. And then I told her all about it. That's what it is, and pray for me. And then I felt better. But here's the thing. Something I never was concerned about before, now, every day. It has to be every single day. I have to lay it down. I have to lay it down. And it's this ridiculous idea that I might somehow get security. That's a joke. You should read any page of the Bible or of history. It's a joke. On two separate occasions, God condemned the Israelites of idolatry because they made alliances with wicked nations in an attempt to provide security, security that God had already promised them. So here's the hard part we might not want to see. Have you compromised on any level, your commitment to radical obedience to the Lord, your commitment to generosity and faithful giving, your commitment to loving your neighbor, living open-handedly, serving people, your commitment to radical obedience on any level because of the idol of financial security? If so, even a little, you're not going to want to see it. I didn't want to see it. God had to hit me over the head with it. And then he used Natasha as a follow-up. I was like, I got it. You didn't have to do the second thing, but fine. You're not going to want to see it, but you got to see it. And bow your knee and submit fully to Jehovah Jireh, our provider. All right, number two. Number two, don't check out on me, guys. I know this is hard. I'm doing this because I love you, and I have to stand before God one day about giving account for all the things I say up here. So that's why we're going on to number two. And number two is sexual gratification at the expense of others. Verses 15 and 16 say this: what sorrow awaits you who make your neighbors drunk? You force your cup on them so you can gloat over their shameful nakedness. But soon it will be your turn. Whew. Soon it will be your turn to be disgraced. Come, drink, and be exposed. Drink from the cup of the Lord's judgment, and all your glory will be turned to shame. Now, what he's doing here, this is a euphemism. It's not really hidden very well at all, about getting people drunk so you can have sex with them. Now, a lot of times when we look at specific practices from the ancient world, thousands of years ago, when we're studying the Bible, this very old book, we have to consider and try to maybe even fill in the blanks about what the modern equivalent of that thing might be. Not so with this one. Getting people drunk so you can take advantage of them sexually is still very much in style. Trouble is, we have added to this list. We have added to this list. We have more ways to objectify and take advantage of women today than the ancients could have even dreamed of, and they probably did. So here's the thing. Maybe you don't make a practice of getting people drunk so you can take advantage of them. If you do, congratulations, it's Repentance Day. You made it. But probably not, right? But here's the thing. And feel free to look at your shoes, it's fine. If you view pornography, I mean, you see there's essentially no difference, right? There's no difference. It's sexual gratification without relationship at the expense of others. See it, right? And even if you don't use pornography, there is what amounts to softcore pornography plastered all over everything. Have we noticed? You've noticed. Surely you're not even going to nod now. Have you noticed? It's everywhere. Our society, I mean, we're just drowning in these images. And it's not just like two-dimensional pictures. Sometimes it's like three-dimensional humans in the flesh walking all around us as women, yes, and also increasingly men say, it's okay, you don't have to objectify me. I'll objectify myself. All around. And call me old-fashioned, which, seriously, call me old-fashioned. It feels more and more like a compliment these days. Fine, call me old-fashioned. But our approach to sexuality in our culture is just completely unhinged. Guys, folks, we've just lost the plot, you know? We have lost the plot. And I don't think, you know, how far down the road, I don't think the Babylonians have anything on us when it comes from this. I think we're looking back at them. And so all the more reason to take the warnings of God seriously, to push back the norms and strive for purity. Heart, body, mind. You guys ever play Temple Run on your phones? Do you guys know that game? Temple Run or Minion Rush or Subway Surfer. They're fun. They're these infinite runners, okay? And they're all based, I think Temple Run was the first. And you go running out of a temple, and there's this horrible creature chasing you in order to maul you, okay? So you just run frantically, and it's called Infinite Runner because it never ends. You just run until you die. That's the game. Yay. So you run and try to stay alive. And then if you stumble once, then the horrible creature is now, you can hear the footsteps and you can hear them breathing down your neck. You stumble twice and that's it. You're mauled. It's over. That's the deal. That's the game. Trying to be a godly man with a desire to be pure before the Lord in our society today feels a lot like Temple Run. We just wake up in the morning and just run frantically from temptation. And if you stumble once, it's breathing down your neck. You stumble twice, you're mauled. Just wake up and run. Wake up and run till you're mauled. Then get up and run till you're mauled. That's kind of how it goes. And a lot of folks have said, you know what? I can't run anymore. I love Jesus. I don't want to run. I'm tired of running. I'll just be addicted to pornography. Just whatever. I don't like it either. And I don't want it to be that way, but I'm tired of running and I'm just not going to fight this fight every single day of my life. I'm just going to relent and I'm going to try really, really hard to not think about the multi-billion dollar industry and the sex trafficking and the millions of people who are taken advantage of in the process and the millions of marriages and homes that are destroyed. I'm going to try not to think about how it skews my perspective of sexuality, the way I see the world, how it might harm my wife. Like, I'm just going to shove all that to the back because I don't want to run until I get mauled day after day after day. And some men have said, you know, I'm just going to run and get mauled and run and get mauled and run and get mauled because what choice do I have? Because I can't stomach any of the other stuff. And some men, by the grace of God, have figured out that in time, if you walk with Jesus, it actually doesn't have to always be that way. I remember that this was years ago when I was playing Temple Run, and I thought of this, and I was like, "This feels like what I did today." And I was frustrated. I thought, "God, does it always have to be that way?" And He said, "No, it doesn't." As we learn to walk with him in time, our next series is called Walk with Jesus. We'll get there. But as we learn to walk with him, it actually does not have to be there. There actually is freedom. There's actually freedom. And I want to be very clear. Like, I am not trying to paint men as victims in this, good Lord. It is perfectly clear to me that pretty much the whole thing is the product of men's unchecked selfishness and entitlement and power for a very, very, very long time. That's how we got here. And the fact is, while godly men are scrambling in an attempt to stay pure, godly women are scrambling in an attempt to stay pure as well, and also scrambling to get away from a million social pressures and norms that absolutely insist that their sexuality is their identity, it is their worth, it is their purpose, a million lies a day, a constant barrage of unfair expectation, constant fear of being taken advantage of. That sounds worse to me, so I'm not trying to paint men as victims. This is what I'm saying. On both sides of that, we've lost the plot. And it's out of control. And it's been happening for so long and to such ridiculous degrees, we don't even see it anymore. Like, it's become normal. And this is, for some, this is, I can't believe the gall to say things like this, but there are people saying, yes, this is what's right. This is what God has wanted all along. Sexual freedom in every form. That's what God has wanted. And I think, so we're just not gonna say anything about devastated families and broken psyches and people's deep sexual brokenness and in ways that are on a level and magnitude that we've never seen before. Like, it's going to be like this, and then we're going to say this is what God wanted all along? And we've really, really lost the plot. And we need to maybe pause. We're not going to want to see it, but pause and say, maybe sexual purity is not some ridiculous concept. Maybe the King of the universe will empower us to lead such lives. Okay? Selah. That brings me to the third thing, which I don't have time for, so I'll make it quick. The third thing is about making idols out of our own perspective. This ludicrous idea that we know better than God, that's bonkers. Habakkuk 2:18 and 19 say this: what good is an idol carved by man or a cast image that deceives you? How foolish to trust in your own creation, a God that can't even talk. What sorrow awaits you who say to wooden idols, wake up and save us. To speechless stone images you say, rise up and teach us. Can an idol tell you what to do? They may be overlaid with gold and silver, but they are lifeless inside. So listen, thousands of years ago when this was written, humans were especially impressed with their own craftsmanship. And so they worshipped the work of their hands. Today, we are especially impressed with our own intellect. And so we bow down and worship our own ideas. We say what's right and wrong. We say what's just. We say how things should be. Because somewhere along the way, we decided we know more than our Creator. This is the mindset. If we can't explain it, it can't be real. Which makes our brains the ultimate authority, doesn't it? If I can't explain it, it can't be real. If it doesn't align with my sensibilities, it can't be right. And there is no absolute right and wrong except believing that there is an absolute right and wrong, which is absolutely wrong. People say that with a straight face. Because we're smarter than God now. We're doing Habakkuk because it's been a rough year or two, right? And when it's been a rough stretch, people find ways to try and cope with stuff. And usually they're bad. And Sharon and I figured out how to cope with something. We cope with this in general, and it's also bad, not a good thing. So my name is Aaron. My wife's name is Sharon. It rhymes. We're adorable. Okay? Aaron and Sharon. And one of the things we've done in order to just cope with the frustration of things the last year plus is we have allowed the emergence of our alter egos, Darren and Karen. Okay? And Darren and Karen are... their filters are broken,
and they say whatever cynical thing comes to their mind. Darren and Karen, it's not good. So we'll do this. We'll do this on. We did this not long ago on a road trip, and our kids called us out on it, which is a shame because then you have to punish them, and they're good kids, you know. I'm just kidding. We were on a walk. Let me be clear. I was on a walk with Karen, okay? Not Sharon. Sharon wouldn't say this stuff, okay? But I'm taking a walk with Karen, and Karen goes, oh, I just love this. I just love how people have decided that they're smarter than God. That's great. Christians, we're going to trust God to save our souls, to be the glorified Christ to rescue us from eternity, but we're not going to listen to what he tells us to do with our time or our money. That's great. That's brilliant. And then she just went on. Oh, yeah, he's holding our molecules together. In him we live and move and have our being, but surely we know better than him. And then Darren jumped in and fed the flames for a little bit. And then after a while, we're like, okay, we got to stop. This is, maybe we're bitter. And yet, I don't know. Maybe Darren and Karen are onto something. Like, I gotta finish the sermon. It's just ludicrous to think that we would know more. It's just ludicrous to think that we would know more. To believe even one word of the Bible and then think that we know more. Can't rant on that one. So let's just pause and ask ourselves. We're not gonna want to, but let's ask ourselves. Have we made an idol out of our own intellect? Here's the question to ask. Is the standard really what God says? Or do we tend to downgrade what he says if it doesn't align with our own sensibilities, with our own conclusions? And if so, on any level, maybe you're way down that road or just a step or two, I'm just telling you, it's really, really, really shaky ground. Because you may be an awesome person and the smartest person in every room you walk into. You may be amazing in every way. You still make for a lousy God, no matter how great you are. Okay, David, I can't do any more. I want to close by looking at just a couple of verses here that I know this is all heavy, and you're like, this isn't normally how you preach, Aaron. I know. There are a couple of verses that scream out from this chapter. So God is just going through, and he's listing the moral insanity, okay? But a couple of times in this chapter, he stops from the warnings, and he just lets just truth ring out and resonate over all the noise. Two verses. The first one is verse 14. He says this. For as the waters fill the sea, the earth will be filled with an awareness of the glory of the Lord. There will be a time and there will come a day. Church kids, you remember this one. Every knee will bow. Every tongue confess. And the knowledge of God's glory, the awareness of who he is, will cover the whole earth. And in awestruck wonder, we will go, of course. It was you all along. You were right all along. It was your ways all along. Your values were better than my values all along. Your priorities were better than my priorities all along. You were always right. You were always good. You were always loving. You were always merciful. You were always working for my good. That day's coming. And the second is verse 20. That's how he ends the chapter. The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. To see the glorified God on his throne and to be struck with silence. It's actually going to happen. The book of Revelation paints that picture. Half an hour of silence in the throne room of God. God just hits pause on everything so that all of the created universe can stand in awe and recognize he is the Lord. His ways are not my ways.
His thoughts are not my thoughts. He is the Lord. So, the verse says, the Lord is in his temple, let all the earth be silent. And we're at the end, and this is where we take a couple minutes for silence. So let's, with Selah, as we do each week, take a couple minutes to focus, to pray, invite the Lord to speak to us as personally as possible. Maybe we would survey these questions. We've talked about money as security. We've talked about sort of giving up on the pursuit of sexual purity and been challenged on that. And we've talked about the sort of bonkers but very human thing where we feel like we probably know better than the one who is high and lifted up. So perhaps in the stillness we can sit with these things. We can be silent before him, King of kings and Lord of lords, and allow him to speak to us on these things. I'll get us started, and you have a moment to pray on your own. Jesus, you are good and faithful and beautiful and true. You're better than any of us know. And it's so very human to think that we know better, or that maybe your ways aren't quite right, or maybe we can modify those a little bit. So we're just going to kind of hold still here for a minute and allow ourselves to be lovingly tackled if that's what's needed.